Welcome to Little Atoms on Resonance 104.4 FM, a live talk show about ideas and culture, with an emphasis on ideas of the Enlightenment.
Little Atoms is presented by Neil Denny, Padraig Reedy, Richard Sanderson and Becky Hogg, as well as regular guest presenters.
Little Atoms actively promotes science, freedom of expression, scepticism and secular humanism.
Our guests bring ideas that are challenging, sometimes controversial, often polemical, but always interesting.
Good evening and welcome to Little Atoms. I'm Padraig Reedy and co-hosting tonight with Neil Denny. Our guest is Joe Baker, so I'll hand over straight away to Neil to introduce Joe.
Thank you, Padraig. Joe Baker, or Joanne Baker, studied physics at the University of Cambridge and took her PhD in astrophysics at the University of Sydney in 1995. She is the author of the best-selling 50 Physics Ideas You Really Need to Know and is an editor at Nature magazine, where her speciality is space and earth science. Her latest book is 50 Universe Ideas You Really Need to Know. So, Joe, welcome to Little Atoms.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
What I think we're going to do is we'll talk about some of the 50 ideas about the universe, but I think if we'll just sort of try and link them to some sort of current things that are going on in the world of space and astronomy. But before we do that, let's just talk a little bit about the book. And what I'd like to know is, how do you decide which things to include?
Ooh, it's a sort of a filing problem, really. So I wrote this book, it has 50 chapters, each of which is like a mini essay on a lot of the topics, and also has a sort of a smattering of little items which try and draw you in to each of the chapters. So it has quotes and little boxes and diagrams and stuff like that, hopefully done in a sort of accessible way. And this the book, which covers astronomy ideas, it sort of develops, it's part of a series which covers 50 ideas on various other topics. So I originally wrote a book about physics, covered 50 physics ideas. This is the sort of subsequent book I've done, because I just found astronomy, it's so rich and has such a long history. It goes right back sort of to the Greeks and Galileo, and it just needed much more space to try and get into the ideas and the big sort of cultural implications that astronomy has had. In terms of how you choose those ideas, it was quite a challenge because the history is so long. So basically I sort of had in my head, I guess, a sort of huge uber list of topics that I wanted to touch on somehow, and then I just tried to pull them together into sort of themed sections, hopefully in a sort of slightly buzzy way or with the odd buzzword, but the idea being to convey as much as possible, really.
So who is the book aimed at?
The book's aimed at anyone, really. So when I give these books to my mum, and she was able to sort of quote Carl Sagan back at me within minutes because she enjoyed some of the quotes. My mum doesn't know anything about science and wonders what on earth I've been doing for most of my life. So the book is aimed at anyone. It's aimed at people doing A-levels and O-levels in physics. It's aimed at the bored businessman at Heathrow who wants to sort of get his head around something other than his tax returns on his flight to Zurich. And it's aimed at the retired person in the Midwest who's kind of just wants to get back into their youth and learn how things have developed, maybe since we all did physics when we were at school.
That's very specifically targeted there, the retired person in the Midwest.
No, they're the people who write to me most often and pick out the queries.
Let's dive in and look at some of the subjects you look at then, and the first one, which is the one that's most topical, is the sun. Let's look at the sun, because so we don't really get that many opportunities to be topical on Little Atoms, but right now as we speak
there is a sun
out there, and it's doing things.
So it's been giving off these coronal mass ejections, which is the outer layers of the sun are sort of driven by lots of magnetism. So they have very strong magnetic fields and they sort of snap and crackle and pop and do sort of weird things, and every now and again they just chuck off huge amounts of particles, and these particles race across the solar system to the Earth, and then they get sort of funneled in by the Earth's own magnetic field towards the poles. So you get to see these things lighting up the night sky as aurorae and sort of other sort of colourful displays of light that we can see in the northern and southern hemispheres. So in the last week, there were three of these sort of massive ejections of particles, and those had supposedly hit us. One was meant to hit us yesterday evening, but I noticed this morning when I listened to the radio there was a lot of very disappointed people out there. And so it didn't make a great impact, but there's a couple more headed our way, I believe, over the weekend. And I believe there's an Aurora Watch website that listeners could go to if they wanted to actually get some warning of these things. I think you can get a sort of half-hour warning when they're about to hit the Earth, and they will let you know if they forecast a really strong aurora, which you might see from northern Britain. I don't know about London.
So apart from the pretty lights, what else can these things do?
Well, they have taken out entire electricity systems. So in Quebec in the 1980s, they were hit by one of these very large events, and it did take out like the city for several days, I think. So they can, you know, just basically, because we live with electronics nowadays, they can wreak havoc on our electronic systems. So that's why it's important to sort of worry about space weather a little bit and try and keep an eye on what's coming out of the sun.
So how and why do these happen? What's going on in the sun?
Well, the sun has an 11-year cycle of activity. So every 11 years, it sort of works itself into a bit of a frenzy. And the sunspots on its surface, which are the sort of dark freckles that you see, they're sites of particularly intense magnetic activity. And so those kind of like come forth and disappear in these 11-year cycles. And so I think at the moment there's a sort of particularly nasty sunspot kind of doing its work, and that's the source of this particular coronal mass ejection.
Let's talk a little bit about the, you know, what's going to happen with the sun at the moment, because I want to then get on to, you know, the other stars elsewhere in the galaxy. So
the sun's about 4.5 billion years old, and it's a pretty average star in our galaxy and a pretty average star in the universe, actually. So it's about halfway through its life, so we're pretty safe for at least another sort of, you know, for many billions of years. And then basically what will happen is the sun, it burns hydrogen, so it's mostly hydrogen, and it burns it at a sort of steady rate in the core of the star, and it turns it into helium. And it sort of goes through this sort of cycle where it just sort of constantly does that. But then one day it'll have burnt all the hydrogen, and it'll have to start burning helium. So it'll go through sort of various stages of its life in the far distant future, and it'll sort of exhaust all the different fuel supplies it has. And it burns all these things by a process called fusion, which is to do with actually, which when you sort of take a small atom or element and you sort of, by pushing it together, you sort of form larger elements that way. So it starts from the lightest element, which is helium, and then builds up heavier and heavier elements as it burns through all those things by sort of nuclear processes. So in another 5 billion years, it'll have exhausted most of the fuel in it, and then what will happen is the outer layers will sort of bloat and be sort of thrown off. It'll maybe become a sort of a red giant for a while, and then it'll eventually, all those gases will just sort of go poof and disappear into space, and it'll sort of contract into a white dwarf, which is a very, so everything that's left over, the sort of ashes of the sun, will just condense down into a tiny, tiny white dwarf, which will just be all that's left.
You've raised something else that's, well, I'm going to really stretch the concept of the idea of topical now, but people have been talking about Betelgeuse, one of the stars in the constellation of Orion, basically going supernova at some point.
Well, so some stars, when they reach the end of their life, so the sun isn't big enough to turn into a supernova, but bigger stars, and Betelgeuse is much bigger than the sun, what happens when they die is they sort of shed their outer layers and they get sort of blown away into the cosmos. But then what's left still has its own gravity, so it sort of pulls itself back into itself in a sort of ultra paranoid move, and it sort of, and then it just sort of all crushes down into as smaller space as it can go. And ultimately, what the thing that stops it from collapsing into a black hole is quantum physics, and that sort of keeps some of these atoms actually sort of slightly apart from other atoms, and so that it all crushes down into a sort of tiny, tiny space. And that's what a neutron star is all made of, and why it's called a neutron star is because it's sort of made up basically of fundamental particles just sort of hanging in there, not quite enough, you know, under enough pressure to become a black hole. So supernovae happen when really big stars, so the outer stuff just blasts off, and then the inner stuff just sort of falls inward, like if you threw a load of flammable material onto a bonfire or something, it just kind of goes nuts, and then the inner stuff just sort of collapses in, and that's what happens in a supernova.
I want to look at one of the ideas or discovery, basically, that you talk about in the book, and these are the Fraunhofer lines, which are basically, there's this barcode within light that we can identify elements by. So let's talk about what that is and how that was.
These barcodes are really, they're very, very useful in astronomy. So astronomy, it relies really heavily on certain techniques to try and work out what things are made of, how far away they are, how fast they're moving. Astronomy is basically the application of some really basic ideas, but they're very fundamental. So one of them is this idea of Fraunhofer lines, which are kind of black, so it is just like a barcode. If you took the sun's light, and this was sort of discovered in the 19th century by people including Fraunhofer, who's a German scientist, if you take the sun's light and then you split it through a prism, so first of all you get the rainbow of colours, but if you look much more closely, if you split it more finely, you see a series of dark lines in the sun's light, so just like a barcode. And each one of those lines is due to a particular energy level in an atom in the sun. And each one of those lines, they fall into almost in chords, actually, each one of those chords, so just as you play them, the black keys and the white keys on the piano or something, each one of those things maps out a particular element. So hydrogen, being the most abundant element in the sun, has a series of very particular lines, and each one of those lines occurs at a particular frequency. And so by looking and seeing that pattern, you can say, oh, look, the sun's got hydrogen in it. And similarly, there are patterns that will tell you it's got, helium and carbon and oxygen and other sort of lightish elements we can track by looking for their barcodes. So it's a very powerful method.
So this is how we can tell what stars that are basically millions of light years away are actually made of without going there.
We can look at anything. We can look at a whole galaxy. I mean, everything in space, if you split its light, you can get the chemistry of it by doing that and looking for these fingerprints.
So your PhD thesis was in studying quasars.
Yeah,
So let's talk a little bit. Well, we should say what a quasar is first of all.
So quasars. Some of our listeners may have heard of pulsars. So pulsars are very fast spinning stars that pulse in radio waves. But quasars are different things, and they're actually entire galaxies which have a very large black hole sitting in the middle of them, and that black hole is just gobbling up gas and stuff, and then just chucking out and burning it up and chucking out as much light as the entire galaxy, just coming from this very sort of dense central point, which is, so essentially it's like putting out all of the energy in stars in the Milky Way just coming from something the size of our solar system. So it's a really bright, concentrated source of light, and these things can be seen right across the cosmos. So there's some of the most distant things we can see are quasars, actually.
Let's talk about how you would have used the spectroscopy that we've just been talking about
So when I was a student in Australia, so I used to go off to the telescope and actually measure this. So I would split the light from a quasar, and these quasars could be sort of billions of light years away. So light travels at a fixed speed.
Sorry, it may be a terribly technical question, but how do you split the light?
How do you split the light?
If it's too technical, don't worry.
No, we split the light using a sort of grown-up's prism. So a prism does a reasonable job of getting you a rainbow, but if you want to really spread it over an entire table or something, and really look in the detail, then you have to use something else. So we use something called a grating or diffraction grating. So it's essentially like a slide. You can buy these in science museum shops actually often. So it's almost like a slide, and it has lots of grooves in it, and that forces the light to go through all the grooves, and then the light waves, which are like water waves, they have peaks and troughs, and all the peaks and troughs of the light waves interfere, and some of them reinforce and some of them cancel out, and the end point you're left with is that the light spreads out in the same way you get for a prism, but you can do it with much greater power and much greater control over how much you can spread the light. So you can go to incredibly fine detail with that and fairly basic sort of optics.
There was I wasn't aware until I've just read that section of your book, but we've talked on the show before about the quantum physics two-slit experiment thing, where the idea of the lights forming a sort of interference pattern behind. Yeah. But I wasn't aware until I read the book that there's also a fingerprint in that interference pattern with various elements. Is that right? Am I getting that right?
Well, the light. So the light spreads out when you pass light through the slits. Then the amount it spreads out depends on its wavelength. So if you put laser light through these slits, then you get a pattern which is essentially a barcode, but it's very well defined. Mm-hmm. If you put white light through those slits, then you'll get the barcode, but you'll sort of, if you imagine, like the red light and the blue light will sort of fall on top of each other and blur everything out. So you have to sort of work within those constraints to try and get what you need. So at the telescope, you would choose particular gratings to get the detail you need over the range of wavelengths that you need. So if you wanted to observe, generally you would just sort of limit it to one bit of light. So you might look in the red part of the spectrum, and you might then split it so much, at fairly low resolution to see the features you wanted to see. If you wanted to look in detail at one particular wavelength, then you'd have to use a much more powerful diffraction grating. So it's a sort of juggling act between all those things.
You're listening to Little Atoms with our guest this week, Joe Baker. So, before I rudely interrupt you on the question of how one splits light, we were talking about going to your lab in Australia and you study in Australia. Are there certain Australian? We're all kind of aware of massive radio telescopes in Australia and optical telescopes in Australia. Are there certain kind of particularly good areas for astronomic research, and where does Britain fall in that?
So, well, the nice thing about being an astronomer is that, especially if you're an optical astronomer, so if you look at visible light and go to the big, what we think of when we think of an observatory is a big white dome sort of sitting on top of a mountain. And the beautiful thing about all those places they're in hot, sunny places, which generally coincide ideally with mountain ranges, sea and good wine-producing regions. So they're actually lovely places to go. So you can go to, South Africa and the Canary Islands and Chile and Hawaii. So astronomers get to go to some pretty nice places in the course of their work. So Australia is one of those places where you can do very good astronomy because it has clear skies. There are many different types of astronomy. So because the electromagnetic spectrum, it stretches all the way, so from radio waves, so the waves that you're listening to this programme on, all the way up to X-rays that you'd use in hospitals, and gamma rays, which are even higher energy. So there's a whole spectrum of different types of electromagnetic waves. And astronomers, basically, they want to use any tool that's in their toolkit. So they want to look at the universe in as many different ways as possible. And radio waves are actually proved quite an interesting and very different way of looking at the universe. And Australia and the UK have both sort of pioneered those techniques. So when I was at Sydney, I used to combine sort of both radio astronomy and optical astronomy. And then I came back to the UK and I worked on sort of radio astronomy. I used to run a little radio telescope up in Cambridge, which I used to go visit every day and make sure it was still ticking along. So the UK is actually quite well... It has a very long history in radio astronomy. So places like Cambridge and Jodrell Bank are very sort of illustrious places. Mm. But the thing about radio astronomy is it was very much sort of centred in the sort of post-war research. So it had its sort of peak in the 1950s, 60s when it discovered quasars and things like this. So radio astronomy, it finds high-energy particles which emit radio waves. So it finds things which have high-energy particles and magnetic fields out there in space, but it's very sensitive, so you can see a lot of stuff. But since the sort of heyday, then radio astronomy, the way to go deeper and deeper into space is to build bigger and bigger telescopes. And I suppose in the UK, we haven't so much done that. So the Americans have built things like the Very Large Array, which features in the film Contact with Jodie Foster. And there are plans afoot to build a global sort of consortium are trying to build a big telescope called the Square Kilometre Array, which will fit lots of small dishes over a region which is a square kilometre. Mm. And that will be sited either in South Africa or in Australia, and they're still making that decision. So the UK, for it to be sort of in doing good science in radio astronomy in the next few decades, has to sort of get its act together and be able to deliver technology to projects like the Square Kilometre Array. And they are very well poised to do that. So there's a number of groups in the UK, including places like sort of Cambridge, Oxford and Jodrell Bank in Manchester, who are building sort of cutting edge, machines and detectors and stuff to actually do radio astronomy and contribute to the Square Kilometre Array, which should come online sometime like 2020 or so.
A field of astronomy that's quite, you know, fashionable at the moment, for want of a better word, is the hunt for exoplanets. So let's talk a little bit about where we are with that, what's going on, because there's been recently some quite exciting item news in there.
So in the last couple of weeks, so the sort of latest discovery is a planetary system. So it's a sun-like star, and then it has planets which are, well, it has about five or six planets have been spotted going around this star, and these have been detected by a satellite called Kepler, which is out there. Basically, it's just taking snapshots of one patch of sky and just looking for tiny blips in the light in front of stars as planets go by. So this is sort of one of the most complicated sort of solar system-like things we've seen out there in the universe.
So let's look a little bit about that technique, a little bit more about that sort of technique. So how are we actually, because we can't see this, obviously, there's not some really telescopes powerful enough to actually see these planets. So how are we noticing the planets around?
Yeah, there are a couple of different ways of doing it. So one of the methods is to look for little dips in light as a big dark thing goes in front of it. And another way is to use the Fraunhofer lines, the spectral lines in the spectrums, because they're tied to particular sort of properties of atoms, and ionized gas. They have very specific frequencies. So you can, if you have a moving source, so just in the same way that an ambulance siren changes pitch as it goes past you, when a moving star or something moves past you, the frequency of its light just shifts slightly. And we can detect that sort of wobble in the star if it has a planet going around it. So if you had a star like the Sun and it has a big planet like Jupiter going around it, that planet will sort of tug the star slightly out of its orbit and it'll seem to wobble back and forth. And we can pick that up just in the light.
I don't know if you noticed, we had a fortuitous example of the Doppler effect a little earlier. There was a siren went past outside. Let's finish up by looking at I sort of meant to raise this when we were talking about the Sun earlier, but it's still worth talking about because it's a really beautiful thing. One of the ideas in the book is the Olber's paradox.
Yeah.
So let's talk about what that is.
Yeah, no, that's fantastic. It still makes me feel pleased because that means anyone. It's a really profound observation that anyone can make, which is that the sky is dark. Mm-hmm. So just the fact that the sky is dark is telling us that either, you know, the universe is not infinite and it has to stop somewhere, or there are hidden things in it. And actually, astronomers have not found anything sort of hidden. So things, you can't sort of hide stars out there in the universe because they would just sort of re-emit their light. If you hid them in a big dark cloud of dust or cosmic debris, they would re-emit their light at longer wavelengths in the infrared. Mm-hmm. So we know that the fact that the sky is dark, it tells us there's a limited number of stars. It tells us potentially that the stars may have evolved, that they haven't existed forever. It just tells us some very basic things about the universe. So it's a lovely observation.
So what the alternative to that then is that this paradox is that if the universe is infinite, that means there's stars everywhere. So what we should expect to see is basically the sky would be completely light.
Yeah, so just like if you're standing in the middle of a wood. So if you're in a small wood, you can see light coming in through the trees. But if you're standing in a huge forest, then you have no clear sight lines. So the same is true of stars. So if you just piled the universe full of stars, it should, if you do the maths, it will actually turn out that every bit on the sky should be as bright as the sun if the universe was full of stars. And the fact that it's not is a very, very profound observation.
We've managed to get through the show without, well, I say that, we don't know if we're still on air. We might, the show might have been taken out by a solar flare during the mid thing, but we'll hope not. So, Joe, thanks very much for coming and speaking to us on Little Atoms.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Little Atoms. You can find details of upcoming guests at our website, littleatoms.com. The Little Atoms podcast is available on iTunes. Thanks for listening.